That was a full fail right there. That was me. That was a complete and total fail as I hit the Dream Theater first. Let's all just pretend that didn't happen. Hello, Don Taylor. How are you on this Friday?
I'm great.
Did you catch my fail right there?
I did.
All right, that's
awesome.
Don't
let that make you cranky.
I'm not cranky. Shut your hole. All right. Let's see. Shall we begin today's program?
Sure.
All right, ladies. And I always feel bad for deafening people with the Attention FM DJs thing or the Attention Portland broadcaster thing, because it just comes out of nowhere. And if you're busy adjusting your iPod or whatever, and it's just going to be suddenly out of the blue, I always feel like I had to play some sort of a "this is a level test, so you do not deafen yourself" sound. All right. We're going to start this instead of our usual speech. Today we're going to start this with a little bit of a I'm not going to play the whole thing because it's just it's interminable, and you'll understand what I mean. There's a little bit of a request here. So without further ado, we begin today's installment of the Rick Emerson radio program. Ah, I've done it twice in a row. Damn it. All right.
Attention broadcasters.
Thanks.
In the greater Portland area, your daily show prep begins now.
Here's the thing. Is it inexplicable as this may sound? That was actually a request. We actually had someone who specifically requested that song. That is the, have you never heard the musical stylings of Kevin Blechdom?
No, I haven't.
Kevin Blechdom was actually a woman, is a musician of some kind from the City of Angels in your own former hometown of Los Angeles. So, amazingly enough, as well, that's not the worst thing. Let me just see if I can find the worst thing. Hold on a second. Now, what better way to start a Friday? Hold on a second. Let me just never let it be said that Rick Emerson doesn't give the people what they want. So that was Kevin Blechdom's performance of Private Dancer. This is probably the song, at least on this show, for which Kevin Blechdom is best known. Let me just... Hey, kids, who remembers this one from back in the day? Sing along if you know the words at home.
Oh, wow.
Use your heart.
Here's the thing about this song, though. It's going to be stuck in your head for the rest of the day. You will be... This is what it sounds like to have a nervous breakdown, by the way. This is... If you're having some sort of mental collapse, this is exactly what it sounds like in your head, I think. Call Art Bell on the Wild Card Line, east of the Rockies, 503-505-6964. Yeti Line, 503-505-6964. And on the Chupacabra Line, 503-505-6964. Ah, there you go. All right, I'll make it go away.
Wow, that just gives me the stabbing pain right in my forehead.
Somebody said, and the guy, he couldn't remember what her name was. But somebody said, "Hey, you know that Private Dancer song, the really crap version you played a long time ago? Did you find that?" And the answer is because I save everything, because I'm an insane pack rat for bizarre sounds and music. So there you go, Kevin Blechton. It is 24 minutes after the hour of one, and this the month of July in the year of our Lord, 2010. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day, live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. This, my friends, my compadres, my fellow travelers, is Rick Emerson, a creeping part of the Red Menace. It's 503-505-6964. You want to join us? If you want, you should talk to us. 503-505-6964. There goes the great on-turning of the phone. There we go. 503-505-6964. It is Friday. Thank you for being out there, etc. If you'd like to engage with us via your computer, you can do that as well. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com or don@rickemerson.com. You can also engage with us via the text box. That's located at rickemerson.com. You just go to, it says text. It says chat or something. I think it says live chat. That's where you go. Or again, the email address is rick@rickemerson.com. And the phone number is 503-505-6964. Coming up later on the day, we have a geek watch, also a penis watch. Also on the table in front of me, it appears to be two bottles of Viso. And when I say bottles, I mean bottles. I don't mean bottle like can. I mean bottle like bottle.
Indeed there are.
So now, where did you find this? Now, I was to understand that Viso in the bottle was only available in upper crust sections of Portland, to which I was denied entry.
Well, thanks to my laziness this morning, because the plaid pantry is a little bit far afield of my home. I have to make a special trip there. Or I can go to the 7-Eleven. But then I have to turn the opposite way from where I'm going toward the freeway. It's just, you know.
Life is hard.
Life is hard. And so this morning I was just like, and I looked at the clock and I said, I'll just stop at Kettleman's where they have the bagels on my way, because I drive right past there and I know they have Viso. So I do. I drive past there. I pull up. I go in to get the Viso. I start to reach for the can. And what do I see?
You
beneath
don't see
the
cans.
No, they have the cans too. They have one row of cans and below that a row of bottles.
Awesome. And so what have you brought here?
I have brought for myself the new bottled Star.
And that's the passion
fruit?
Which
is blood orange and passion fruit.
All right.
And for you, your usual Vigor.
God bless you.
In a bottle.
All right. Here's the... Oh, man. I don't even... Okay, I got to wait. I got to hold off just a little bit, because if I open it now... Okay, I'm not going to wait. I'm going to open it now.
Yeah, I'm not waiting.
All right, there you go. So this is... You know, there are times that I just feel like I had to backbill that guy for the number of mentions he gets on the show. I don't know, I was opening the brand new bottle of Viso. Now, I know that they've reformulated Star to go into the bottle, and it is in the trademark. The bottle is shaped a little differently, but it's in the trademark Viso blue bottle. You know why? Because that keeps the sun's harmful rays from degenerating and deteriorating the minerals and vitamins contained within. Oh, that's the stuff right there. You know what this is? My friends, I'm about to say the words that many of you have been wanting to hear for about a year and a half now. You know what this is? This is exactly the flavor it had when it was in the bottle the first time around. I should say, by the way, that I'm not being paid to do this, although clearly that ought to be the case. That is exactly the Vigor that I... And don't get me wrong, I like the Vigor in the can. I really do. The Viso that they got now in the can, I have no problem with. I know a lot of people do. They think that he reformulated it in a way that they don't really care for. But I have no problem. But this, now it's the best of both worlds, because I got the new Viso flavor in the can, and then I got the classic flavor in the bottle. Oh, that's awesome. Right.
Wow, the Star is really good. My big problem with the new formulations of both the diet versions in the can, where they seemed really I don't know, thick. The flavor, they tasted really heavy.
Well, there's more juice in them, that's why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is a lot more refreshing, and it's a little bit sweeter, but not in a cloying sort of way. And no, I am now officially on board with the star in the bottle.
This it really is
quite delicious.
That's quite good. Thank you, John. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
All right. In any event, it is 503-505-6964. Penis Watch on the way. Geek Watch on the way. We'll talk to author Bill Carter. He's the man behind the film Miss Sarajevo and the books Fools Rush In and Red Summer. By the way, and I don't know, I mentioned this to you before the show today. I don't know if I'll find a way to sort of slide this into the conversation with Bill Carter, because he is a really cool guy. He has a serious story to tell in Fools Rush In especially, but he's a great guy. He is not a sort of overly serious or downer interview, which it could be because he talked about spending some time in Sarajevo. But my wife is reading this book of his, Fools Rush In, which I think Bono described it as being, you know, some sort of a modern sort of Dante's Inferno, as kind of lived by one guy as he sort of went to Sarajevo during the height of the conflict there. But my wife is reading Fools Rush In, and so every night she's reading in bed, and she'll occasionally just stop, and it's his real life story of how his fiance was killed very tragically in a car accident, and you know, obviously just out of the blue, and he decided, you know, what a cruel charade is life. Where shall I go to find my meaning? And so he just kind of wandered the planet and just ended up in Sarajevo, just some guy. You know, because he wanted to help people, and I think probably because at that point he will tell you he didn't care if he lived or died. So my wife is reading this book where he just goes, you know, he goes on and on about how his life had essentially lost all of its meaning because of this tragedy, and then he goes over to help people in Sarajevo, and every now and again my wife will just look up and she'll go, he's so dreamy. I mean, he's really, no offense, I mean, you're great, Rick, but he's perfect. And then she'll just go back to reading. So there you go. So there's that. That's all on the way. We'll do today's top five as well. Top five ballads that ruined a rock band. That's coming up today. Top five ballads that ruined a rock band. And Dawn Taylor is tracking the following stories for you on this Friday.
48 dogs are rescued near Goldendale, Washington.
Is this story going to make me angry?
No, it's well,
I mean, there's,
yes.
Is that when they say 48 rescued out of the 300 that she had in her home, all the rest of which had to be euthanized and burned?
Well, no, it's not that bad.
Okay, all right. Well, in any event.
There's been a $1.6 million settlement in the chassis case. And a man is suspected of stealing a ladder in Washington County.
Is that really a big problem? Do they only have the one ladder? They got to pass around the entire joint there?
Well, he actually, you know, is suspected of stealing other things, too. But it's the ladder is really the linchpin to this whole story.
All right, there we go. And this is all true. Also, today we'll have Pop Culture Authority, and we've been threatening this for like 9 days in a row, but we'll do the other Pop Culture Authority today, too. That is the question. What are phantom clowns? That's coming up today. So, Pop Culture Authority, what are phantom clowns? What are the top five? Top five ballads that ruined a rock band. Author Bill Carter, Penis Watch, Geek Watch, and more. And now with the news desk, ladies and gentlefolk, it's Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
The computers went all wonky there for a second. Here's Dawn Taylor.
Dozens of dogs reported to be malnourished and in unhealthy conditions have been rescued in Klickitat County. The Klickitat County Sheriff's Office said they were notified by a concerned citizen about the dogs on July 24th, about 10 miles east of Goldendale. When crews arrived, they said they found dozens of sick dogs living in unsanitary conditions, many of them in small kennels with no food or water.
Are you kidding me?
And having wounds and other medical problems. In all, 48 dogs were impounded, including several puppies. The dogs, which were Rottweilers, German Shepherds, and Doberman Pinschers, were being housed in various shelters and foster homes. Kay Smith, founder of Dead Dog Walking Pitbull Rescue, said it was a very sad situation, one in which many dogs were saved and not spared. There's been an outpouring of support from the community, other shelters, rescues, and strangers.
Really?
In
I think
country.
There ought to be an outpouring of floggings for the community, and then an outpouring of beatings, followed by an outpouring of... Never mind. See, this is... Yes. This.
Charges will... likely be filed.
The charges, which
the
will
58-year-old resident owner,
almost
where the dogs were fed.
Certainly be insufficient, and a punishment which will definitely be insufficient. All right. We have to. When I say, "Is this a downer of a story?" and then you say, "Well, not entirely."
They saved them. and they're going to go into foster homes.
That'd be
and
like
be,
saying that if I just held you down and beat you with a stick and set your legs on fire, but then, you know, but then like somebody saved you, it wouldn't be a downer of a story. It'd be a great story.
Okay, it's a terrible story. It's a terrible story.
Seriously, what is the name of the offender in this case?
They didn't actually say.
Are you kidding me?
No.
Okay, well, we're going to find out, and then we're going to say. And then,
they're going to get in the book.
And then, this is why I don't own a gun. That's all I'm going to say. Because you find, all right, I'm going to stop. I'm going to calm myself down because it's Friday. And it's, no one wants to be upset on a Friday. Let me just, let me turn that frown upside down. How could you not smile when listening to this, Don? Here's Don Taylor at the news desk.
That drum just...
It burns.
It hurts me.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this will cheer you up. Novelist Anne Rice has had a religious conversion. She's no longer Christian.
I thought she was all Jesus-y and whatnot.
No, she says, in the name of Christ, I refuse to be anti-gay. I refuse to be anti-feminist. I refuse to be anti-artificial birth control, she wrote Wednesday on her Facebook page. In the name of Christ, I quit Christianity and being Christian.
That doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, not that I expect internal consistency from faiths or religions of any kind, but I mean, just pick a hole and, you know, stick your identification plug in there and stick with it.
Well, she was raised as a Catholic, but had rejected the church early in her life, yet she renewed her faith in recent years, and in 2008 released a memoir called Out of Darkness, A Spiritual Confession.
Now, didn't she start writing a bunch of novels that were all about Jesus, though? Isn't that her thing? Because she wrote, Anne Rice obviously wrote Interview with a Vampire, and most notably, Queen of the Damned, her finest work, apparently. And but didn't she say that all of her novels going forward would have, like, a Jesus aspect to them?
You couldn't actually pay me to read her books at this point, so I
oh, I didn't
know.
I didn't read it. I just, it was a thing. It was because, you know, it was one of those things that sent shockwaves through the nutcase Anne Rice community. And there was some talk from her, I do believe, that she felt like she was going to try to regain control of the copyright of her work because she didn't want some of her vampire novels to be read anymore because she felt that they were sacrilegious and blah. And so anyway, so she was just
I guess apparently she had been reading what they refer to as a metaphysical fiction series, Songs of the Seraphim.
Yeah, and she was going to be writing a bunch of sort of fantastical novels, though, that did feature Jesus as a character. And she had actively sought, I believe, on some level to regain control of her early work because she didn't want it available to the public. And it was like she was just doing everything she possibly could to irritate her fan base. It was sort of great to watch, actually. It was like a sort of hilarious literary performance art, because Anne Rice fans, and I don't mean like casual fans, I mean people who are really, really into Anne Rice, they're just bonkers. They're just nuts, all of them. And it was sort of gratifying in a way just to see the circle of insanity spiraling out of control.
Well, it sounds like she realized that this whole going Christian thing, going
not
going
to pay the bills,
isn't going to pay the bills. Because in a telephone interview, she said she'd been having doubts for the past 2 or 3 years. She's troubled by the child abuse scandals in the church and the church's reaction and the excommunication of Sister Mary McBride, a nun and hospital administrator who had approved an abortion for a woman whose life was in danger. And then she also says she's a Democrat who supports health care legislation and yada, yada, yada. She said she will not be taking up vampires again, but she is a big fan of True Blood and enjoyed the first 2 Twilight movies and is interested in seeing her most famous character, the vampire Lestat, return to the screen.
Oh, hey, by the
way. We're in talks about it, she says.
By the way, have you seen the third Twilight movie? I keep meaning to ask you this.
Because
I know you have this weird compulsion to finish the series, even though it's terrible,
Yeah, even though I can't read the books, and here's the thing. I have the movie at home. I've been attempting to watch it. I have returned to it 3 times. I can't seem to watch for more than about 15 minutes before my mind starts to wander, yeah, and I realize I'm not paying any attention to it, and I'm thinking about laundry and stuff. So then I turn it off and go back. And on top, with all of that said, it's actually, in my opinion, it's not nearly as bad as the first two movies. It's actually a lot better.
I heard they were sort of steadily getting better, which means that if they made like 50 of them, eventually they would make a fine film.
Yeah. But it's one of those things where I just really don't care. And so then I start watching it and then I find myself thinking about, you know, like whether I have to buy more milk or something and then going, okay, and why am I doing this again?
Yeah, yeah.
Why am I even bothering with this?
Well, that was the that's the indication to me when I that is how I know when I have stopped really caring about a television series or a movie, because I'm a big fan of the you know, I will pause, and you know, if I have to get up for even a second, if I just have to get up to fluff a pillow on the couch, I'll pause it because I don't want to miss a second of the action. So I'm a fan of seeing, you know, a movie or a TV show every second of it, front to back. You know, because you never know when you're going to miss something. And the minute I knew, for example, that I'd stopped really caring all that much about Dexter, not that I don't watch it, because I still do. I watch every episode. But I now, like, if I get up and wander into the kitchen to get myself, you know, like another slab of, you know, of lard in some form to eat, I don't even bother to do it to stop at the playback of it. I just keep it running. Now, maybe I'll turn up the volume a little bit so I can hear the conversation while I'm rummaging through the fridge. But I no longer really feel like I got to just, you know, halt everything until I get back. So that's a giveaway that you don't really care about the movie, but that you're watching it for some sort of completist satisfaction.
Well, one of the things that struck me, though, that I've been watching it is the big conflict in the third one is whether Bella is actually going to become a vampire after she graduates and then be with Edward forever and ever and ever and ever, or if she's going to be swayed by Jacob, who also loves her. And says, you won't have to be different for me. You won't ever have to change. You could just be with me. But then he tells her this whole thing about like having to take a mate and imprinting on somebody. And so, which I kind of missed part of that because I realized I wasn't really paying attention while he was talking because I was thinking about milk. But one of the things that really struck me when I was watching this is that both of her choices suck. They just both really, really suck. The entire... All of her life choices in this film come down to which guy is she going to tether herself to?
I was going to say, around which man will I focus my entire existence?
Is she going to let Edward drain her of blood and then be eternal with him and his pasty-faced family, living like in the rainforest for the rest of his life? Or is she going to go be with Jacob and spend the whole rest of her life living with a pack of shirtless bohunks in a cabin?
Well, it is. And the thing about the Cullen family, I can't even believe that I'm sitting here having this conversation. The thing about the Cullens is they are like some sort of weird Ewok meets elves family. You know what I mean? Where they're like living in a tree, you know, but then they're all just, you know, they're all so pale you can see their internal organs. So it's like it is like the members of Depeche Mode decided to live on Endor. I mean, that's basically what the Cullen family is. But for some reason, here's the thing. I think I mentioned that I made it through I powered through the first Twilight book. I mean, it was like mowing wet grass, though, about halfway through. I was just like, Christ, is this book ever going to end? And, which is especially dumb because, you know, my wife read it in a day she read the first Twilight book in. Now, granted.
And both of you did better than me because I got about three chapters in and I just went, ah, screw this.
Oh, no.
And I just tossed it aside and was angry.
She hurled it aside with extreme prejudice. I damn thee. She started at like 7 in the morning because I think she'd gotten up for work. I think she ended up being sick. I think she had to get up to call in sick for work that day. And she's like, well, I guess I'll read this Twilight book, whatever the kids are all talking about it. And so she opened it up. And I came home that day from work. And I didn't get home till like 8 or 9 for some reason. And she was still on the couch. She had not moved, apparently. I don't know if she had the... I don't know how she dealt with all of her functions that day because it seemed like she was in exactly the same position. And I said, hey... Were you still reading the book? And she went, yeah, it's awful. I can't quit reading it. And she finished the entire series of books because she felt like she had to. It was like the sort of itch she had to scratch. But about, I don't know, by the end of like the second book, even, you know, she knew they were terrible. But I finished the first book. The weird thing about the movies is that they're so unbelievably bad that it's like they make no impact on me at all. So it's not even – they're bad in a way that is not even painful to watch. It's like they're a complete non-entity. They just – I am so totally indifferent to them. I think maybe that's the thing is it's not like a movie like Napoleon Dynamite where I sit there and I am just thinking of ways to kill the filmmakers. I'm thinking about the soft music that their agonized screams will be to my ears when I finally deal with them. with Twilight, it's like I'm able to sit there and just think about, yeah, grocery lists or like, you know, I gotta take those shoes in to get the soles redone. Maybe I'll do that tomorrow. I need spark plugs for the car.
Yeah? Well, you know, and I saw the first two movies, and then this movie starts, and it's like there's this whole thing where there's these vampires, and they're coming, and they're going to come after Bella, and everybody has to gather together to protect Bella. And I'm sitting here thinking, Why do they want to kill Belle again?
Yeah, no,
I know that had something to do with the second movie. I don't remember.
We should probably...
And I didn't care enough to go find out.
We should probably, at some point, I don't know if we'll have a chance to do it here. We're going to talk to Bill Carter here in just a few, but we should talk a bit about True Blood, only because that episode is... There's a new episode of True Blood coming up this Sunday in addition to Mad Men, so we should get back to that. All right, well, let's plunge on ahead. We'll do some news here. We'll talk to author Bill Carter here in just a few. This is Dawn Taylor.
Detectives said they believe a man arrested on suspicion of stealing a ladder could be responsible for other thefts. Washington County Sheriff's deputies said they arrested 36-year-old Kevin Gilman for first-degree theft and are investigating similar incidents in the area. Scott Fairbairn, a painter and carpenter, said two of his ladders were stolen just days apart. He later recognized one of his ladders while talking with a neighbor. The guy had separated out the different ladders to choose the most valuable one, Fairbairn said. It's part of what I need to survive, and in this economy, business is slow. Deputies said Fairbairn will have one of his ladders returned after spotting the suspect driving with it. I walked into the middle of the street and held my arm out just like this and said, "That's my ladder. You stole my ladder," he said.
Is there nothing else going on in this town? Is this a... please tell me this is on the front of the local Picayune in like 80-point type.
This is Portland news, baby.
This is actually in Portland?
Yes, this is a Portland story. This
not
is
on the
local
outskirts
story.
Of Portland.
No, no.
Not in some
no.
farming community that is maybe in no. the furthest reaches
Portland,
of our...
Portland, Oregon.
All right.
I walked into the middle street and held my arm out. That's my ladder. It's very brazen, and I don't think he thought of any of the ramifications of his behavior. I think he was just out to serve his own need. Detective said Gilman could be responsible for several thefts and tried to sell
all of it. All of ladders?
They just said several thefts. Maybe he's stealing nothing but ladders.
What was your thought process in choosing this story?
Well, there were two thoughts. One was ladders, because ladders are just funny. Uh-huh. And the other was, it's a really slow day for local news.
Awesome. Okay.
Fair enough. As evidenced by the fact that this came off of, like, I think the KGW website.
This just in. All right. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Also coming up later on today, by the way, we'll have another installment of Pop Culture Authority. We'll answer the question, and I don't even know what this question really means. What are phantom clowns? But the thing is, having heard the question, I now long for the answer. We'll also do the top five. Top five ballads that ruined a rock band. That's coming up later on. Top five ballads that ruined a rock band. Still on the way, Geek Watch, Penis Watch, and we'll talk to author Bill Carter. This is Dawn Taylor at the news desk.
8 human heads have been found in 4 locations outside the northern Mexican city of Durango. The victims were men believed to have been aged between 25 and 30, the local prosecutor's office said. Police found the heads after anonymous tip-off, but had not identified the victims or found the bodies. The state of Durango has been the scene of clashes in recent months between rival drug cartels. And police received tip-offs that 2 heads had been dumped on 3 roads, and then a cleaning crews on a traffic island found the remaining 2.
Good Lord God. That's a bad day at work, is what that is.
When you're just finding heads.
Honey, I'm going to be late. There's all these heads to deal with. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. Our guest today first entered the cultural mainstream upon the release of Miss Sarajevo, a documentary which documents his work providing humanitarian aid during the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina, as well as a book called Red Summer, which talks about summer spent in a fishing village on the outskirts of Alaska. Mr. Bill Carter, hello, sir.
Hey, how you doing, Rick?
I'm doing well, and I'm glad to hear that I have not technologically fumbled things now as I begin this. You, just to give a little bit of history here, you had been a guest on Outlook Portland a few weeks ago, and as my underhost, Dawn Taylor, will tell you that after we had you on Outlook Portland, I came over here and I was just going on and on and on about what a fantastic story this is, and I recapped it just the real briefly there, but... In Fools Rush In, which my wife is finishing right now, and which she's just absolutely she's over the moon about. I mean, she's just in love with that book. You talk about spending some time in a place that everybody else on Earth was sort of actively avoiding in the 90s, which is Bosnia-Herzegovina, you know, during that whole uprising. Tell me a bit about... Because you were just sort of an ordinary guy who ended up in just this amazing war-torn city at just the worst possible moment in history. Tell me a little bit about the chain of events that kind of put you on that trajectory.
If you kind of hear the story cold, or, you know, as a pitch, if you might say, it just doesn't make any sense. You know, it just, it's kind of too fantastical, but it's bizarrely how it happened. Just normal guy, living here, meaning in the United States. There was a series of events that kind of emotionally put me in a place that I think I was ready for, a place like Sarajevo. I had a fiance who had a tragic car accident and died, and that happened in 1990, and I kind of basically lost the plot, as it were, and went into a pretty big grief spin cycle, and which took me to a year in Trinidad in the West Indies, and then kind of traveling to South America, and then eventually I kind of woke up one day, and a friend of mine, a really good friend of mine who actually knew Karina, had been started to work in Croatia for the war relief efforts and for the UN. And I said, well, hey, you know, I think I'm going to come over there and do something. And he said, no, please don't, because he knew my state of mind. And then I went. And, you know, I didn't really know much about what was going on, but I knew a lot about the world and about people. And I was probably in Croatia for about 2 weeks before I got my ride into Bosnia, into Sarajevo.
You talk about at one point the Sirius Road Trip, which is a humanitarian aid organization you joined, and this sentence was written about them, and the sentence says, quote, they distribute food and medicine to places where the United Nations and the Red Cross will not go, end quote, which it is an unbelievably terrifying way to describe a location. I mean, you know, the Red Cross especially, which has this image of being so danger-defying, you know, where it doesn't matter how risky something is, the Red Cross will go in. Why would the Red Cross not even go there?
Well, the Red Cross, you know, had a role definitely in Bosnia and in most conflicts. But Bosnia was, it was extremely violent, really kind of off the hinges violent, and in pockets. And some of these pockets were very, very not easy to get into. And a lot of what happened in Bosnia was political. And people were, you know, the whole place was defined by international politics. And if you did this, it meant this. If you did this, it meant that. And a lot of deals had to be made. And we were not really deal makers, per se. And we just would just say, screw all that, we're going to do it. So while people were making deals, or people were, you know, hemming and hawing about things, we just went and did it. And that didn't make us a lot of friends with the UN bureaucracy. It made us a lot of friends with various UN personnel or NATO soldiers who wanted to help us, you know, because they knew we were doing a good thing. But it didn't make us friends of the bureaucracy, who basically likes to control access to places like a war like in Sarajevo.
When you walk into a city like Sarajevo, and everybody, you know, you hear these descriptions in popular culture where they talk about, well, it looks like hell on earth, or it looks like absolute unleashed total chaos. But those are all just such hyperbolic descriptions that they almost, you know, you almost don't even know what they mean. When you actually arrived there, and you say, well, you get out of the car, of the jeep, or whatever, and you say, well, here I am, and you look around. I mean, what does a war-torn city actually look like? What are the hallmarks of a city that is in the midst of that?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's beyond eerie. It's very surreal. It's nothing that we've been prepared for, as this generation. You know, if you talk to someone maybe in World War II, they'd be able to describe it. You're walking into a city that's very urban, very, you know, going into, you know, any urban city that, you know, Portland, whatever, it doesn't matter. All the buildings are empty. A lot of the glass is gone. There's shell markings, bullet holes, close encounter bullet holes, like, you know, thousands of bullets riddled the wall, everywhere. No one's in these buildings. There's no electricity. People are walking, but you don't know where, you don't know why, and they have like firewood, or they have maybe a baby stroller full of water, like, you know, buckets and buckets of water. No one really talking. You don't know where anybody lives, you don't know where anybody hides. You don't know where anybody's going. When it becomes nighttime, it becomes even more eerie because there's no lights. So if there's a, let's say it's a starry night or a moon night, you basically look out your own window wherever you are, and you're looking at a silhouette of, like, you know, the New York skyline with no lights, except for maybe a candle in one window or something like that. It's a very strange experience. It's like the shell of humanity. It's like, what was that movie with Will Smith, I Am Legend? Or
right.
Something, you know, where it's just a city. There's people there. That's the weird part. There's like 250,000, 300,000 people that were left. About 200,000 people escaped right when the war began. And they're just hidden in various little tunnels and places all over that city. And then they come out to get water. They come out to get food. They come out to do important things they have to do. But unless you stay there a while, you don't really know how this thing is functioning.
You talk about in the book a lot about the going there because you had a sort of a sense of emotional numbness after your fiance's death, and you wanted to the overarching find yourself, but also just because you wanted to sort of feel something. And so there you are. You're, as you describe it, this city of 300,000 people, bullet holes everywhere, and just signs of destruction and reminders of death all around you. Yeah, I mean, you must have, even despite your numbness, been just terrified, though. I mean, you got to look out their window at night, and you're just seeing this place you're in, and you're hearing maybe the sounds of war, and it must just terrify you to your core.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. People think I was, you know, local people have a real laugh at me saying I was crazy. They don't really mean crazy, crazy, but the things I did were crazy. People from this country don't understand what I did or why, or was I scared? I was always scared. It's a primal fear. There's no way around that primal fear. When an artillery shell is coming towards you, you're scared. You know, when people are firing bullets at you and you're running and the guy next to you is dead, you're scared. However, I wasn't scared like day to day every second. I was scared when things were happening, but I was actually I found myself the first 2 weeks very, very scared, disoriented, and maybe wanting to leave. And then what happened is I met some people. Finally, I met people. I mean, I wasn't having any real human contact. I was delivering food with these guys, but it was kind of delivery and get out of there and very impersonal. And then I met some people, and I kind of found myself suddenly, you know, going through the looking glass. You know what I mean? All of a sudden, I fell through the rabbit hole, and I went into someone's home and had lunch with, like, a can of tuna and one spring onion, and they laughed and laughed and laughed and told stories, and they were all horrific, but they were laughing. And all of a sudden I started to feel like, okay, there's a way into this place through people. I just gotta find these people. And so the fear was always there. Don't think I was never scared. I was you're always scared. You can't help that fear. It's a very difficult thing to describe to someone when an artillery shell goes over your head. I mean, the nearest I can describe it is you literally will probably poop your pants and your hair grows gray, you know, and that happens to people. Hair will go gray within literally an hour.
During this period of time, you had started working at one of the local, one of the radio stations there, this sort of community radio stations, probably not the right way to put it, but you were there and you were doing some sort of limited broadcasting, and at one point, your life intersected with that of Bono from U2, which is just the most surreal thing. I mean, it makes it look like you just sort of flipped through the yellow pages and you went to, like, let's see, Bombastic, Grandeur, there we go, Bono. And, you know, and how did you come together? How you're there, you're some guy, as you put it, in Sarajevo, and then suddenly your life and Bono is kind of crossed. How did that happen?
Yeah, it's kind of fantasy. It's probably the most ridiculous part of the story in terms of how it happened. Is I had seen them on a television show talking about United Europe, and I it didn't make me angry, but it made me a little bit like, obviously that's not true. So they're Irish. They have a false religious war going on for hundreds of years, which really usually means, just like this one, it's not religious, it's power playing, it's money, it's black market, it's all bullshit. So I thought I'd reach out to them. The problem is I know they're not going to listen to a lone American young guy, because it's, you know, they're too big a business and too big an operation to deal with that. So, Bosnia was on the forefront of European minds. So So I knew that if I could get a piece, if I could get a fax with the stationery of the television station of Sarajevo out into the world, I would get people's attention. So that was my first mission. The second part of the mission was not to be me, because that wouldn't work. So the second part of the mission was I need to be someone legitimate. And so a friend of mine was an editor at the TV station, and I used his name and acted. He wasn't even the managing editor. I just acted like he was. And I got a piece of stationery from him. It took about a week to get it faxed out of Sarajevo, because it's very difficult to fax something out of Sarajevo. Also, to get the fax for U2 was difficult. But I did fax them, and I didn't hear anything. And then I used the radio from downstairs. That was a French humanitarian organization, had a boat radio, and I connected to the Dublin office of U2 called Principal Management, and I said, you know, hey, I sent you a fax. Are you interested? And they said, yeah. You know, they're on a tour. They really want to do this, but we've got to figure it out. Eventually, they sent me something back to Croatia, my friend in Croatia, saying, hey, we'll meet you in Verona. And then I had to get out of Sarajevo, which was not easy, and to Verona, which also had its problems. And then I had to interview him. You know, and I had a camera. My friend didn't know anything about cameras, so that was a problem. I was more interested in stealing the food in the green room than I was anything else. But we had a good interview. You know, we had a really good night. And it's a really, really touching story. I didn't know them at all. We met. We did this interview. He was transformed, as he will tell you, transfixed maybe. And later on, afterwards, they brought me to Ireland, and I was sitting with Edge and a writer for Rolling Stone. And Edge said, when he came out of that room interviewing with you, he came into our room. It's just kind of the room they go to privately before a show, and said he was crying. And, you know, he said, I've known him since he was a kid, and I've never seen him cry. And all of a sudden, we were like, whew, you know, something happened in there. And so we were all on board, and U2's never really ever lost. I've never lost your support in all these years for all this, so it's really been great.
It seems like one of those things that is just the absolute alignment of the planets, because a band like that is just so impregnable. The organization around them is structured in a way that is deliberately designed to keep people from getting access to the band. And so I think it almost seems like your sort of brazenness in approach probably circumvented that. If you had tried to go through maybe more traditional channels, they probably would have just told you to get bent.
Yeah, I think that, you know, knowing them now and knowing how they operate, and which isn't unlike a lot of these kind of, you know, high-powered organizations, definitely, I would have gone nowhere. I tell you, it kind of harks back to one of the underlying themes of the book. You know, I can sit here now and talk to you about things I did and the things that, you know, it took a lot of people helping me to do what I did. Is that I think it worked because I didn't want anything. You know, I didn't want anything from anybody I was asking besides to pass the baton further down the field. I didn't want money or you know, a dinner with them or, you know, whatever it is. I didn't want that. All I wanted was a very simple thing, which was to give somebody else a voice, and that's it. It's a really simple thing.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say it really is just an amazing thing, and I cannot recommend enough that people watch Miss Sarajevo. And then I was talking about this actually before you came on the show today, that my wife is reading Fools Rush In right now, and she has this ritual. She reads for about an hour before bedtime, and she's reading your book, and she's talking about how this ultimately, this story sort of climaxes, and it's not like a big spoiler or anything, but the story sort of climaxes with, during the Zoo TV tour, U2 letting Sarajevans just speak very openly in an unfiltered way to the world. And it seems so impossibly like Nick Hornby meets Cameron Crowe meets Hunter Thompson meets Norman Mailer meets Edward R. Murrow. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And every now and again, my wife will just kind of put down the book and she'll go, you know, Bill Carter's just perfect. I mean, you're great, Rick, and everything. But, you know, Bill Carter, he's really just fantastic. He's awesome. And then she'll just go back to reading it. It just is an astounding story. And then you have Red Summer, this other book, which is you talk about the lives of these commercial salmon fishermen in Alaska. Is the thing, do you just look at a map and you go like, what is the worst place on earth where people have it harder than anyone else? I'll go there and hang out with them. I mean, you just look around for a place where everything is just sort of sucks and just decide that you're going to go there and document it?
No, you know, that, I hear what you're saying, but no, that's not it. And I some people think that, but it's funny because after Sarajevo, I had a lot of people wanting me to go to different wars. And I'd been to a lot of wars, but they wanted me to go to war, this war, this war. I'm like, okay, you're missing the point. You know, the two books that you've read, Seven and Fool's Ocean, do have something in common, which is they are both, you know, people living in very extreme situations. One is a war and one is an isolated village in southwest Alaska fishing, a Yupik Eskimo village. But, you know, the thing I'm very attracted to is it's a dual thing. One is inside myself and one is the people I'm going to meet, and they probably are tied together, which is one I like to push myself, not to death, but to push myself out of my own comfort zones, which then reveal things to me, or I pay attention more, my senses are higher. It's not really thrill jock, yeah, sense kind of thing. I'm not going to fly out of a helicopter or, you know what I mean, a bungee jump or any of that stuff. But the second one is people. People are the same thing. People reveal themselves in these situations in a way that reveals the true character, who they are. And I find myself very, very drawn to that. And it's not to make a judgment, and it's not to, you know, it's not to say you're right or wrong, or not to write a story like that, or even think like that. It's just that I find I'm very comfortable in places where people are, the extreme has made them who they are. And sometimes it's very, very dangerous, but I'm comfortable there. And I'm very who I am. And these books are full of who I am. I'm not, you know, hiding myself behind some sort of veil of, well, your wife says I'm perfect, but obviously I'm not. I'm obviously a stumbling guy in many ways in Fool's Ocean. And in Red Summer, I'm a novice fisherman. But, you know, so are we all, right? I mean, I'm you. I'm you, the voice of whoever, all of us reading a book like that is, I don't know how to fish. So here I go. I'm going to learn how to fish.
Part of me wonders if your agent is just looking through a list of non-lethal professions or places that you could write about and just say, I don't know, there's a really interesting pet store in Ohio. You're almost certain to come back from there intact. Please write about that. Write about being a pastry chef or something.
When I was pitching my next book, which, you know, I have a deal with Simon & Schuster, Scribner's, and my editor who edited Red Summer said, hey, you know, you got to find something that's not going to kill you.
Yeah.
And this one I'm writing is not going to kill me. It kills a lot of other people, but it's not me.
Well, I have to say that really, I just based on the people I know who have read it, and I'm sort of waiting on my wife to finish her copy, who have read Fool's Russia, and they just rave about it, and Red Summer as well, and Miss Sarajevo is fantastic. So best of continued success in all things, and really just for having really an amazing story and wringing the absolute most out of your life up to this point, no doubt in the future. So thank you for spending some time with us.
I think I'll be in Portland in October, so, you know, I'll be back up.
Awesome. We would love to talk to you then. Thank you so much, my friend. Have a good weekend.
You too.
All right, there you go. That's author Bill Carter, ladies and gentlemen. And the books are Fool's Russian and Red Summer. And his film is Miss Sarajevo. So there you go. So there's that guy. So there's the... And then he's, like, well-dressed, and he's, like, a good-looking guy, and he's sensitive, but he's tough, but he's, you know, but he cries, but in a manly way. You know what I should have said? It's almost like, it sounds like I got some big man crush on Bill Carter, and maybe I do. But the thing about this story, especially the Fool's Russian story, is it's like if Hemingway wasn't just some deluded alcoholic jackass. It's like if Hemingway actually existed the way that he clearly wished that he existed. Hemingway has that sort of projection of the idealized masculinity. And I very much get the sense that, like, this guy is sort of like the actual reality of that, as opposed to the sitting around and, you know, the boozing and then having, you know, and then, like, getting some guy to take you marlin fishing. So there you go. Also, I've accomplished nothing in my life, by the way, just FYI. Just him and John Rogers back-to-back. You want to feel like a loser. All right. How are you, Dawn Taylor?
I'm a little depressed, actually.
Why?
I was feeling bad listening to, you know, and imagining Sarajevo and the wars and the bombed-out buildings. And then, like you, just being like, wow.
What about True Blood?
What am I doing with my life?
It's...
Yeah. After this is over, I guess I'll read my little clown story.
It really is a pretty astounding thing. You can actually watch the interview with him on Outlook Portland that we did. You go to outlookportland.com, and Yeah, and he tells the Sarajevo story. Yeah, actually, there's a lot more that we don't get a chance to talk about there. But the pretending to be multiple people on the phone, like on one phone conversation, actually pretending to be more than one person because he knew that they wouldn't take him seriously if he was just some nitwit using, you know, the French boat radio like in the basement or something. So anyway, so there you go. Measure that guy against yourself all weekend.
Yeah.
All right. It's 503-505-6964. On the way, we do have various amusements because that's the way that we ease the existential horror of life for our listeners, Dawn, is we bring them,
people joy.
Well, you know, the Red Cross brings food. He brings them Bono. We bring laughter and amusement. So that's all on the way. We'll do a little thing here. We'll come back on the other side. You stay there. It's the Rick Emerson Show on the Emerson News Network. Don't go anywhere.
I'm a desperate man. Send lawyers, guns, and money. This shit has hit the fan. Guns and money. Send lawyers, guns and money. Send lawyers, guns and money.
Phantom clowns
from the Emerson News Network. This is Pop Culture Authority.
I'm Dawn Taylor. In mid-July 2010, a Wisconsin man fired several shots inside his home and later told police that he had been terrorized by a gang of clowns. The police concluded that the man was hallucinating. No clowns were found in the vicinity. To those suffering from coulrophobia and irrational fear of clowns, or who were traumatized by the sharp-toothed sewer-dwelling Pennywise from Stephen King's It, the grease-painted jackanapes who cavort at kids' birthday parties are less a delightful entertainment than they are a queasy-inducing menace. And of all the phobias one can have, of bridges, enclosed spaces, spiders, etc., being terrified of clowns is, admittedly, the funniest to those who don't suffer from it. But clowns may not be as innocent as you think. For decades, people have reported terrifying encounters with what are known as phantom clowns, in which they're terrorized by brightly costumed apparitions who leave no evidence behind of their presence. In 1981, the Boston Public School Board investigated incidents in which two clowns used candy to entice children into the back of their van parked near an elementary school. Soon after, children in Pittsburgh also reported that they were approached by two clowns, also in a black van. 2 weeks later, in Missouri, authorities chased a knife-wielding clown in a yellow van that had been reported at six different elementary schools. The police received dozens of calls that day, all reporting the same clown. In 2000, a man dressed in a complete clown costume and holding three helium balloons tried to lure children into the woods in Wisconsin. The clown was wearing bizarre black face paint, which led police to conclude he wasn't a, quote, legitimate clown. In 2008, a clown with a painted teardrop on his cheek used the balloon trick to try and lure children into a van. Again, there were multiple clown sightings in the area, with some of the clowns being seen on foot near a park in elementary school. Researcher and cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman investigated the phantom clown phenomena and was struck by two things. The clowns were never apprehended, and the events were reported in at least six major cities spanning over 1,000 miles. In his book Mysterious America, he compares the clown sightings to mass hysteria incidents, as well as to the Pied Piper and 19th century Black Jack legends. But how to explain the similarities in the sightings? Are there evil tricksters masquerading as clowns to gain our trust? Or are there, in fact, evil phantom clowns who wish to do us harm? Ask a colorophobic and they'll tell you. Clowns are terrifying. And up to no good. Phantoms or not.
The final word on the only knowledge that matters. Pop Culture Authority from the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. By the way, I've written down the phrase, knife-wielding clown in a yellow van. That's the worst thing I've ever heard.
That's the
worst. Knife-wielding, because I see him sort of sprinting toward the van, like the Insane Clown Posse logo for some reason, and then sort of getting in. And I don't know if it's like a lemon yellow van, sort of a bright, sort of sunshiny yellow, but that's how it looks, you know, when I picture it. And then he's sort of cackling evilly to himself, hunched over the wheel, a maniacal grin on his face. God damn you, you're evil. Evil is what you are.
I'm a scared of clowns, so I can't help but think about these things.
And then right after that, the phrase, not a legitimate clown, which is sort of great. All right, then. It's the... the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for coming by. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. He probably doesn't want to be associated with knife-wielding clowns in yellow vans, so I'll just do the smaller mention here. Note that the cleaning solution, like if you got to get blood out of a suit, for example, he might not be your guy, but out of your floor, sure. In the person of Michael Beatty, the cleaning solution at 971-533-3211, one of the proud sponsors of the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We'll talk more about that here in just a skosh, as our Asian friends say. It is 503-505-6964. Still to come, we'll do the top five ballads that ruined a rock band. That's coming up later on. The top five ballads that ruined a rock band. This is Dawn Taylor at the news desk. I say elongating my syllables just enough that I can... There we go.
And now,
awesome.
From the news desk, this is Dawn
Fantastic.
Taylor.
Fantastic.
Let's do our penis watch.
Damn you.
You're going to love this penis watch, Rick Emerson.
Are you speaking ironically?
I am indeed.
All right.
Sarcastically more than ironically.
Here is your penis watch for Friday right here in the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
Take a look at my enormous penis. And my troubles start a-melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis. And everything is going my way.
Here's Dawn Taylor with your penis watch.
Having struggled to find any willing volunteers, surgeons in Taiwan have been researching the effects of electricity on penises by conducting the operations on themselves. The surgeons were determined to find out whether using a scalpel or electricity was the best way to cut tissue in any operations on a penis, such as circumcision, cutting off warts or moles, or removing hypospadias, an abnormal opening to the penis.
Oh, no, no, no.
But the only way to tell the difference was to perform electrosurgery on a penis. And faced with a shortage of subjects, the surgeons used themselves as guinea pigs.
Where is this?
This would be in Taiwan.
Don't they have prisoners for that?
Perhaps
what?
Not. Perhaps
oh, like
that
it's,
would be
I'm,
wrong.
I'm sorry. Is Taiwan, correct me if I'm wrong, is Taiwan not, are they not under the de facto control of the Chinese government?
I don't know how the decision.
Since when does the Chinese government have a problem doing something that people don't want? I don't want my penis cut off. It doesn't matter. We're the Chinese government. I mean, really, what is it, since when do they wait for I don't want to be run over by a tank. It doesn't matter. We're the Chinese government. I don't want my candy to be filled with lead. It doesn't matter.
I think you make a good point.
I'm just saying. All right. Well, there you go.
The doctors found that although using electrocutting could minimize damage to the penis, it should be used with extreme care.
Really?
Said Dr. Vincent Tsai, quote, injury to erectile tissue caused by electrosurgery on the penis cannot be underestimated.
And probably not undone either. That's the thing. Your penis is injured like that. There's no coming back from that. There's no. Can I just tell you this, you damn horrible woman? That you know something that I've just never. The depths to which I sometimes loathe you in a loving sort of way. I have never gotten over that goddamn story you read about the jackhammering or whatever it is. The
daggering. Yeah, you can break your penis.
See. I don't want to know about that. And I know, you can tell me, I am shifting uncontrollably.
You're twitching.
What my mom would call, she'd say, you got ants in your pants, boy. But it's really just that I'm trying to find a position. This is what it must be like to have phantom limbs. You know, is like, ever
more
know,
or less.
Well, I mean, do you ever know somebody has they're missing a hand or something, but they can still feel their finger?
Yeah.
My father-in-law actually does it. He got no legs. But occasionally I'll be like, yeah, damn it, my toes itch. And then, you know, and he's not crazy. He knows they're not there, but it's like his brain doesn't know or forgets sometimes. This is sort of like that. It's like a phantom broken penis. I'm the only person on earth to use that phrase, by the way.
That'd be a great name for an emo band.
That is really? I, of all the 6 billion people on the planet, I am the only one that had to use the phrase phantom broken penis.
Quite possibly.
Anyway, so I've just never gotten that story out of my head. That's just, especially because I do believe that the story of the daggering and the penile injury that follows, you did say that it was accompanied, I believe, maybe this is just in my imagination, by some sort of a cracking sound. So,
yeah, popping.
Yeah, no.
I actually read about these injuries several years ago, and it was interesting because I don't know if it's changed much, but apparently it's not uncommon for someone to break their penis. And apparently it most often happens when men get up in the night to go use the facilities and they have one of those nighttime erections and they smack into a door or a wall.
I was just about to say, I swear to God, if you finish this sentence, I will come over there and knife you in the eye. But now it's too late. Well, we talked about this last time. I was just saying that is a pain of an intimate and private nature. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it's like the first time that a lady knows the sweet internal touch of a man. You know, apparently that is a pain that varies from woman to woman, from customer to customer.
But I don't think it's even comparable.
No, it is not. And there's nothing you have on you. If you walk into a door, it's going to cause you that kind of pain. The mashing a boob against the door is not really going to have the same sort of effect, I would imagine.
Really. I could tell you a story about an ill-advised use of a close-up cinnamon toothpaste as a marital aid once, but I'm not sure it's you know, really even quite the same thing.
It doesn't really matter if it's the same thing or not, now that we're in the penis watch. when you say a close-up use, close-up toothpaste
yes,
as a marital aid
cinnamon.
By you?
Well, yeah.
When you say a marital aid, that makes me think that it was with someone to whom you were married, or perhaps are married.
Well, no, I was not actually married to the gentleman, but
okay,
I was trying to use a euphemism.
Was he married, though?
No.
Okay.
No.
Just checking.
It occurred to me that when you brush your teeth with the close-up toothpaste, it has a pleasant sort of tingling sensation. So I thought that pleasant tingling sensation might be fun to experiment with, and did not realize that in certain sensitive areas, it turns into an intense burning sensation.
Also, the toothpaste is what they call it's an abradant. You know, it's a scrubbing agent, not unlike powdery spick and span.
It was a gel toothpaste, so I kind of was thinking, no. No, but that was when I discovered just how much something could hurt in that region.
Well, you wouldn't have...
And then we were both running around the house naked, trying to figure out what we could do to wash it off. And finally, it's like soap and water wasn't doing it. And I had this vague thing. I said, I think you could use like vegetable oil on chemical burns or something. And it was horrible.
I don't even know where to go here. I feel like part of my brain has a whole lot of questions to ask. Part of my brain wants to be like tending a Twitter update about this. Part of my brain is looking at the clock and trying to figure out exactly how long I can talk about this before we absolutely have to get off and move to something else. Let me ask you this.
Okay.
Okay. So the Okay, so there you and the gentleman are.
Mm-hmm.
Was this early in the evening or late in the evening? By which I mean, now here's what I mean by that. Mm-hmm. Had you already exhausted the supply of traditional lubricating agents that night?
No, it was mid-afternoon, I believe.
You know what I mean, though. In other words, you know, it's like, well, look, how about, it's like when you bring five rubbers, but you need six or whatever.
Yeah. No, this was more of a... I believe for some reason or not, I think we were going to take a shower together. So we were in the bathroom. And I believe it was one of those things of looking over at the
sink. Well, what do we got in here?
And I went, and some very foolish part of my brain went, hey, I've got an idea.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah. You know the bad idea bears from Avenue Q. Hey, you know what you should do with the toothpaste? Yeah. That'd be awesome.
And so that was actually, that I think, I believe, maybe or maybe not, answers my next question, which was... when using said toothpaste as said agent of lubrication, I was going to ask whether this was this was a thing where you were, whether you were like, giving him a hand with something, doing a good job. Or whether it was actually going to be a sort of actual penetrative...
Well, it ended up on me, too, so I believe there was some sort of a...
Well, on is sort of a...
Well, on and,
Okay, so this... I guess, was it for full-on sex?
I believe it was, yes.
Okay,
it was a long time ago. To be honest, here's the thing. I remember almost nothing about the actual act itself. All that is seared into my brain... is the pain of the aftermath.
Okay.
All I remember at this point.
I guess it would have worked. I guess I should have just started with that then, because I was going to ask if the pain was solely on his member or if it was in your area.
Oh, no.
Oh, see, then that would have answered my question right there, that it was full-on sex.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
See, I thought, well, see,
and that's why I was saying now I do to some extent understand what intense pain in that area. It's not the same kind of pain.
Oh, yeah, you don't want that, baby. No, that's bad.
But I do remember, going, oh, dear God, how can I make this stop? Dear Lord.
I like the idea that you're trying to find some sort of Wesson douche,
wash it off. Wash it off. The soap didn't work. And then I just having this vague first aid kit thing in my hand going, peanut butter, vegetable oil. There's got something.
Have you ever had that? And I know you have. Here's the thing. You and I should not be given a show together. Because normally this is where there'd be like a third person in the room who would interject and say, okay, enough talk about drugs or porn or lubrication agents. We're going to a break. We have to get some measure of self-control. But have you ever had that moment, and I know instinctively that you have, where you are engaged in some act of carnal congress and maybe something goes wrong, but maybe it doesn't. Maybe you just kind of... Maybe you become dimly aware in some part of your brain that you're doing something that could conceivably go very wrong, and that you are then imagining whether or not you will be able to fix it yourself or whether it'll require going to the ER. And then if you're going to be able to put your pants on, before you get to the ER, or if they're going to be one of those things where they wheel you in with your business exposed, and then you become one of those, you know, an area man was taken to the hospital with what doctors say was the most embarrassing condition they've ever seen.
Yeah, that was definitely the toothpaste incident, because there was this point when I was running around and we were trying to solve this, and we were going, oh, dear God, please don't make us have to go to the emergency room like this.
Become an episode of House?
Yeah.
God damn. All right. Well, there you go. Okay, we're done. We're ending then.
Take a look at my enormous
nowhere to go with that.
Saying my troubles start a melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis. Saying everything is going my way.
All right then. Why, hello, you're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you so much for joining us. A couple things. Don't forget, this program is now available on iTunes. I keep forgetting to mention that, actually, here in the show itself. If you're downloading this, well, good for you. If you're listening to it live, hey, hey. But if not, if you want to be getting it on iTunes or on your favorite RSS aggregator, you know, podcasting product, tool, application, whatever, you can do that. You just go to rickemerson.com/iTunes. Or, frankly, you know, you just look for the iTunes logo, click on that, you're going to be good. And that way you download automatically, you got it, it's ready to go. You don't have to go and click and wait and, you know, watch and whatever. You can do that. And also, if you are interested in giving a gift subscription to this program, perhaps to an impoverished soul or someone who simply does not know the glory of this program and all of the many awkward anecdotes that it entails, you can do that by going to rickemerson.com/gift or just look for the Give a Gift subscription link, which is right under the Listen Live button. That's how you can do that, is through your support and your kind indulgences that this program is able to horrify you on an almost daily basis with stories from Dawn's sexual past. It's 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. I shouldn't ask this next question, but I will. Sure. What percentage of these stories do you suppose your husband learns about by listening to you on the radio?
Wow, I don't know. I mean, you know, we've been together for, you know, over a decade. So
that doesn't mean we tell each other everything. Probably.
I know, but we've heard most of each other's stories. We yap at each other so much that every once in a while there'd be this thing where I'll say something and I'll go, really? I never told you that before. I can't believe I never told you that before. I'm sure he's heard most of them.
Here's the thing about toothpaste, real quickly, is that, you know, people don't know this. You know what? You know why toothpaste is, for example, you know why you can't just brush your teeth with, like, Ivory soap? I mean, you could, but, you know, it doesn't have the same, it doesn't clean them in the same way. It will polish, probably, but it doesn't actually get them clean. It doesn't scrub them away. It's because toothpaste, as opposed to regular soap, has abrading agents, which are, in fact, tiny sea creatures. They are shells, or fragments of shells from sea crustaceans.
Is that the silica?
There's silica. Yeah, well, that is the ingredient. When you see silica there, that is to some degree. Yeah, so they'll get basically like tiny, tiny, tiny barnacles, for lack of a better, you know, and then they clean them and sterilize them, one hopes, and then grind them up into a powder and dump them into your toothpaste. And that's the scrubbing agent, which is the same thing they kind of use in Comet. So you're really kind of just using Comet on the inside of your mouth. That's why. See, so when you were talking about the close-up toothpaste being used as an aid to clear the way sexually, I was thinking, see, here's what I was thinking. I was thinking that immediately then there was the application of the toothpaste and then the requisite sort of pistoning motion. And then I was just thinking that it took the epidermis off right away, that it was sort of like, skin gone. The burning had never actually occurred to me.
I think, you know, as best I could recall, I don't think we actually got that far.
Yeah,
I think we just got to the application part, and then we both very quickly went, bad idea.
Bad idea.
Bad
wrong,
idea.
Wrong. Wrong. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Although, yes, you're right about the braiding thing, though, because I recently had a watch. No, this isn't a gross story.
Okay.
I had a watch that I needed to sell on eBay. It was a really nice old Hamilton watch. It was quite expensive. And it had this very, very light, almost unseeable scratch on the crystal. But it's an interesting kind of a weird kind of triangular crystal, and they're really expensive to replace. Went online, looked around. They said, if you've got a scratch in the crystal on your watch, you can buff it out using toothpaste.
I did that with my old BlackBerry screen.
And I did that, and it worked beautifully.
Seriously. They will as they always do, Apple will sell you something, which I believe is called Apple Paste, Apple Sauce, Apple Paste, something, whatever. But it's like, you know, if you get people get a scratch on their iPod or their iPhone and they want to kill themselves. And I know what that's like, because I got a scratch on my BlackBerry, and it was just like the end of my life. And the Apple paste or whatever they call it is incredibly expensive. And I went online, and the guy's like, F that. He's like, get toothpaste. And so I got some toothpaste. And I'll be goddamn it. It took the and it was a glass screen. It just took the scratch right out of it. So, all right, excellent. This is a much better idea.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
The Portland City Council made final approval Wednesday of a $1.6 million settlement with the family of James Chassy Jr., who died in police custody in 2006. Chassy died September 17th of that year after he was tackled by police officers who chased him for allegedly urinating in public. He was also shot with a stun gun. In addition to the financial settlement, the city will be releasing reports on the case, which had not been made public. Chassy family attorney Tom Steenson said release of those reports will go through a brief legal process and should be ready for viewing in mid-August. Chassy family issued a statement reading in part, "The truth is that the civil suit seems to be the only form of justice that our local system will allow when police are involved in a killing. Clearly, the local criminal justice system and the police bureau's internal disciplinary groups, both working hand-in-hand daily with the police themselves, are not currently capable of pursuing the public's interest in these issues."
This is one of those things that I was people ask me, you know, when I was either now or, you know, when I was off the air, they say, well, do you miss the radio show? Does it just kill you to not be on the radio? And actually, I've gotten... I think the first couple times I got fired, you know, you take it way more personally. And then you just, you know, and you're just seethingly, you know, sort of like, you know, like embittered about it or whatever, which is probably the case at any job. And the first few times I got fired, I would just sit around and be like, oh, the things I'd talk about, you know, and I would try to avoid, I would have one or two reactions. I would either avoid the news altogether or I would like binge on the news. Which is sort of either like cold turkey or methadone, depending on how you look at it, you know, where I would either try to avoid the news because it would just sort of annoy me, you know, that I couldn't talk about it. Or I would just read all the news I could. And then I would just bore my wife by just standing in the kitchen and saying, hey, honey, an area man says that, you know, and just this laboriously pointing out things that no one cared about, you know, to my friends and family. So I've gotten over that. One of the rare times when we were off the air this last period. Two things, actually, that I wish I'd really been on the air for, the two stories that I missed. One is Ronnie James Dio passing and shuffling off his mortal coil. The other was this – I mean, it seems like we just had this epidemic of police shootings.
Yeah.
You know, all of them controversial, many of them entertaining. But none of them talked about my me. And so that was really it. That was really the
it
only thing.
It might have been
thing.
Your fault, really, that people were just
them.
Going crazy in the streets because you were not on the air.
It was just it was like every 2 days God would just put as punishment for me some sort of shooting. You know, and it was always a shooting where it was like the man was waving a gun and saying he was going to kill any MFer that he saw and that he wished death on everyone. Police shot him. Community activists are outraged. You know, and then that was one of those things where I would have to fold up the newspaper and just put it away and just not look at it for the rest of the day because it would just, you know, because then it's, you know, then you just become, then you become gruff and unlikable. And nobody likes that guy.
Well, yes, Chassy, as you'll recall, Chassy was taken first to Multnomah County Jail. But a nurse told them that Chassy could not be booked in his condition and that they should take him to the hospital.
I don't recall this, though. This is one that I don't remember. This is from a few years ago.
Yeah. This was 2006.
But this is a guy, he was like, man, he's crazy, right? He had some mental...
Yeah, he was like a homeless guy. And
yeah.
And he was peeing on the side of a wall or something.
Right.
And basically then they chased him down, tackled him, shot him with a stun gun, took him. And by the time he got to jail, the nurse took one look at him and said... you can't book this guy. He needs medical attention.
He's nuts, yeah. And
well, no, he needs physical medical attention. So they turned around to take him to the hospital, and he died on the way to the hospital. When they did the autopsy, they found that he'd suffered 26 rib fractures and a punctured lung. And concluded that his death was caused by blunt force trauma to the chest.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't the taser. It was like a beating.
Somewhere between the tackling, the taser, and whatever happened between his arrest and the jail.
Yes. The 500 or 600 times he fell down on the way to the car.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this isn't the – see, I thought this guy you were talking about here, I thought this was the guy that like ran out of the – that ran out of the bathroom holding a knife covered in blood.
No.
At one of the cops. And the cop mystifyingly thought that he might be in some danger and just gave the guy what for with a bunch of lead. I thought this was that guy. This is a whole different thing.
Yeah, this is a –
So who can keep track?
So of the 1.6 million, so and keep this in mind when you're thinking about like city services and potholes being filled and such.
Where does the money go?
Of the $1.6 million, about $766,000 will be paid immediately by the city of Portland, about $276,000 by the city's insurance company. The balance will be paid out by the insurance company in monthly payments over the next 5 to 7 years. The family has already settled for $925,000 with Multnomah County for a sheriff's deputy involved in the death and a reported $600,000 with an ambulance company.
So, but wait, I sound daft when I ask this, but that is that from the taxpayers as such?
Well, it's coming from the county and from the city of Portland.
So I wonder, but it's from the insurance company. Well,
No. $276,000 of the $1.6 million will be paid by the city's insurance company. $766,000 will be paid immediately by the city, the city coffers.
I wonder if they budget for that. I mean, that sounds so cynical, but I mean, I wonder if the city plans in like some closed door meeting every year. I mean, let me write. This is an idea, you know.
If cops keep behaving the way they have been the last few years, they certainly should.
Well, I was going to say, okay, cops got a difficult job, and let's be honest, most of the people who are beaten are not beaten enough. The thing about it from where I stand, it's that no one is ever beaten exactly the right amount. People are either beaten way more than they deserve. Or they're beaten way less than they deserve.
Oh, I'm sure there are probably plenty of perfectly just right beatings. Just don't ever hear about those.
Maybe. I'd like to think so. I'd like to think that, you know, most beatings are like the middle bowl of porridge. It's just that we just, you know, the percentages, the proportions always seem to be skewed. Anyway, so, cops got a difficult job and all of that and whatever. But you got to wonder if the city does sit down in some darkened room with a cone of silence over them at the beginning of the year and they go, look, and we got to figure that there's probably going to be some cops who just shoot guys in the face for no reason. So how much do we reasonably think that's going to cost us? And, like, how can we set it aside? You know, because you can say that they bill us for it, but at the same time, like, it makes their job harder if they got to go $700,000 in the hole for this. So they must discuss that. They have to talk about that in advance in some hushed tone where they must estimate. There's got to be an off-the-books budget that they estimate verbally to each other, or that's just a wink and a nod about, and we're also going to have to pay off that guy who did that thing with that politician in that bathroom in that place, and he's going to come out any day now. You know?
Or they just have those conversations where they sit there and they go, oh, where are we going to get this from? Well, I guess we're just not going to be able to do that other inconvenient light rail project that no one wants that's just going to, like, tie up all of our streets and our bridges for the entire summer.
You don't even know. For Outlook Portland yesterday, I interviewed Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. She writes the Multnomah County column and whatever. And she's written a lot about the streetcar. Did you know this? You know, the city council, and they're not necessarily going to do this. I mean, they can't because there's no money to pay for it. But, you know, the city council, your city council, Don Taylor,
Not anymore. I moved to Tawala.
It wouldn't be your city council. My city council. You know, they signed off last year on a plan. And again, it's not like they're going to do it. It hasn't been instituted. But they signed off on this sort of, somebody prepared a sort of overview and said, well, we have your plan A, your plan B, your plan C. And they went, oh, plan B. That's a good one. Plan B involves putting 52 miles of a streetcar track down. Putting just 17 miles of that track downtown, because a lot of it would be sort of an outlying areas and whatever, of the 52 miles of streetcar track they're talking about, putting just the 17 miles of track around downtown, how much would you expect that to cost?
$30 million.
$640 million. I made her repeat it back to me twice. $640 million for what is, we must admit, antiquated technology. I mean, streetcars are just... I mean, it really is like one step above just like putting in like a massive butter churning facility downtown. I mean, the streetcars are just ancient, antiquated, old ass technology. There's no reason that should cost $640 million. It's just it's ludicrous. So
I've never been able to figure out exactly what the point is of this. It's like when they did the one down Northwest 23rd or 21st or whatever it was, that seems exclusively there to be convenient for people who go to the hospital.
I can actually tell you why. She actually wondered the same thing. Because I said my whole point was, I said, you know, the problem with streetcars is when I say that they're antiquated, I can already see a bunch of people telling me, no, today's streetcars run blah, blah, blah more efficiently. And instead of use burning coal, they use...
I'm not anti-streetcar per se. Well, I just have never understood exactly who it is we're serving with this enormous outlay of money?
I know the answer. The answer is, because she asked the same question, the answer is, at least in theory, that the streetcar is not for citizens or for riders as such. What they have found in other cities is that where you put streetcar lines, those places are then considered more desirable by real estate developers and businesses. So you lay down a streetcar line and then upscale businesses and like condominiums and, you know, high-rise ensconces of pasty people will follow. That's the deal. You lay that down and then it's like, you know, it's like a sugar trail and the ants come along and the ants are real estate developers. So like the Pearl, they want to replicate that kind of thing everywhere. And they find that if they put streetcar lines down in other cities, then the upscale businesses immediately move in. That's why they want to do it. Because
the Pearl, honestly, the Pearl is a freaking nightmare.
Yeah. Oh, no disagreement from me. But I mean, it's, you know, and the thing about the streetcar line is,
the Pearl is someplace that you see, I think, if you come from out of town, if you don't live here in Portland, it's awesome. It's like, look at this wonderful, like, cool, upscale, hipster neighborhood that they've created. It's also very cool if you have an assload of money and you live there and you work, like, 8 blocks away in, like, an insurance building downtown. Anybody else, if you have to go there for any reason or just drive through it to get someplace, it's a freaking nightmare.
I think we have to spin a wheel every day, and one of us has to be the designated happy person, and one of us has to be the cranky person, or we have to hire some guy, some brainless dick, just to sit here, meet in the studio, and be chipper.
You know that guy, that one guy, Mark, who wants to be an intern so much. He's very cheerful. He might be he could be the cheerful guy if we hire him.
Because otherwise, he's just going to be us going, and another thing that sucks. Whatever happened to, you know?
And there's these words that get into your head, and it's like as soon as the word comes up, it just triggers something. It just pushes a button. Everybody's like, the Pearl. Like, yeah. Oh, the Pearl. Well, I don't know why. It's like I'm a dog looking at a squirrel.
And the reason why it sucks so bad is the same reason that businesses love streetcars, which is the same reason why I don't like streetcars. It's like when I said that they were old and outdated and antiquated, because you dig up the tracks, you lay the tracks, and then once the tracks are there, that's where the streetcar goes. It's not like you can suddenly make it go to the left and down that other street, as opposed to like buses, which are adjustable. But businesses like the fact that the streetcar line cannot really be changed once it's put there, because it forces people to be in the vicinity of their businesses.
So basically, it's an investment for the city, thinking it will attract real estate developers who will build more upscale stuff, and the real estate prices will go up, and therefore they will be able to draw more tax money.
That is exactly it. So there you go. That's the that's Anna Griffin's take on it, and she's been covering it for a long time. So she's a woman who knows things. We had to have her on the show actually. She's fantastic. We'll get her. You know, she can kvetch with the best of them. Really, she really you just get her going, and she was the one who I believe I may say that I may be saying this wrong. She, I believe, is the one who analyzed the city council as though they were high school archetypes, and talked about who everybody would be if they were in a high school. Because she's been, yeah. Anyway, crazy-eyed Amanda Fritz. Anyway, let's just before I do anything else, let me just take a moment. You know, there are some businesses that are not evil and soulless, Don Taylor.
Really?
No.
Like who?
I mean, such as the cleaning solution. Like Michael Beatty is the proprietor of that. You can tell that he's a good person because he chooses to spend his hard-earned advertising dollars right here on the Emerson News Network. He advertises on Legion of News and also right here on the Rick Emerson Show. He can be reached at 971-533-3211. He's been a long-time listener of the show, and of course, he's now a proud sponsor of the program. He's, in effect, subsidizing your listening. That's a good way to look at it. He makes this program available at the low, low, and unchanged price of 32 cents a day. And he is a guy who is able to come to your house and help, or your business for that matter, help clean up whatever it is you might need cleaned up. And it's one of those things where at the end of the winter, or maybe, you know, at the end of the summer, you got a bunch of tracks coming in the front door, or if people are always, you know, like in your living room, you come in the front door and you're always taking the same path to get to the bedroom or the office or the bathroom or something, and you start to wear like a sort of dingy groove in the carpet. You could do it yourself, but it's like, who has time? You just don't. By the time you get home, it's all you can do to get the top off the beer bottle and pick up the remote before collapsing. So, F that. You're an American. Have somebody do your work for you. That's what makes this country. That's what separates us from savages. You can have people do your work in your stead. And that person of that company is Michael Beatty, The Cleaning Solution, 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211. Stain removal, carpet repairs, upholstery, stone, marble tile. Pretty much if you walk on it, he can take care of it, and they'll do residential and commercial cleaning and maintenance. 971-533-3211. Michael Beatty at The Cleaning Solution. music got very manic there for
I
a moment.
I love this music.
Oh, this is Lenny D. Do you not know of Lenny D?
No.
I have all his albums, and I don't mean that figuratively. I have all his albums. And then I also have his two-disc remaster collection right here. Oh, it's all...
Would we have to pay royalties on this if we use this for, like, happy music for happy news on the Legion of News?
Well, he's dead, but I would imagine he's probably got an agent named Maury who keeps a close eye on those things. Oh, yeah, no, it's... And it's all this. This is basically what Lenny D did. I could go on and on about... I'm going to do a whole thing about Lenny D one of these days, a tribute to Lenny D. He just died 2 years ago.
Aww.
I missed my chance to interview him by, like, this much. All right. It's that time once again, ladies and gentlemen. This is your top five for Friday.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire.
Counting is wonderful. Counting is marvelous. Counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness, counting is ecstasy. I love to count, don't you?
And without further ado, here is your top five for Friday right here on the Rick Emerson Cavalcade of Whimsy. Oh, I'm sorry, I should give the headline for this.
I have no idea what the topic is.
I've said it multiple times.
Have you?
You were sitting right here doing a radio program with me. All right. Hey, it's Friday, kids. These are the top five ballads that ruined a rock band.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a relative sort of, and it's a relative kind of ruining. I am not a fan of all of these bands, but, you know, but the top five isn't about me and what I think. It's about bringing a musical truth to the people. I am a sort of melodic Diogenes, bringing the truth to people far and wide. Here's Don Taylor with your top five.
The honorable mention, Aerosmith, Angel.
And this is honorable mention because it didn't ruin Aerosmith as such. I mean, it was a huge hit. I mean, a massive hit and really part of their big comeback. This, along with the song Ragdoll and Dude Looks Like a Lady, was sort of a triumvirate of songs from the Permanent Vacation album, which I quite like in some ways. But the problem is that, like with all ballads, it just became impossible for them to have a hit with anything that didn't sound just like this. And so, Angel, not a bad song. You know, What It Takes, actually, not a bad song. That's a great song. I love What It Takes. Maybe one of the best. That's one of the best ballads Aerosmith ever did. But it's like Angel begets, What It Takes begets Crazy, begets Crying, begets Amazing, begets Blind Man, begets Walk on Water, begets... And it's like they all just, you know, because it becomes easier. The problem with ballads is they're chick magnets. And so where chicks go, money follows, baby. And then it just becomes impossible to do anything but this ballad because the temptation to get the quick hit and to get the dollar is just easy. So you get Aerosmith, which is a classic, I mean, really a classic, iconic American blues rock band that now just does variations on this over and over again. Not a bad song as such, but it just renders the band impotent, like in every other form of music, seemingly. Like, it just becomes shades of this. You have this look on your face like you're smelling something rancid.
No, it's one of the things. I was just thinking that this is one of those reasons, what you just said about power ballads being chick magnets, yet another reason why I've had more male friends than female friends in my life, because I was just thinking about it. I like thinking about a really good friend of mine who is just passionately in love with Bon Jovi. And I've just never understood...
The man or the band?
Both.
Yeah.
But I've just never understood the attraction to this kind of song or pretty much anything that Bon Jovi actually did. So, but there is a specific kind of female that goes for a rather...
Well, don't get me wrong. I am not going to put myself. I'm a big Bon Jovi fan. I have no problem with this song as such or with power ballads as such. But it's like the problem with a power ballad becoming a big hit, like with Angel by Aerosmith here, is that it stops the diversity of the band like in its tracks.
I was just thinking about what you said and just having that look on my face while I was thinking about chicks suck.
You know what it is? You know what the power ballad is? It's like, and you girls know what I'm talking about. It's like when a man figures out one move he can do, either in foreplay or in the actual act, that maybe you're especially fond of. But then he just does that thing over and over and over and over and over and over again, which gets tiresome. And you're like, yeah, I like that, but I like other stuff too. Stop that. That's what the power ballad is. You know, it's the guy who figures out the one lame-ass Mortal Kombat button combination that'll win, and then he just does that.
It's when you as a guy tell your lady that you really like her lasagna, and then she makes you lasagna, like, every week. Yeah. Until you just like her going,
That's the thing.
It's good lasagna, but come on.
Vive la différence is what I'm saying. All right, top five power ballads that ruined a band. Dawn Taylor?
Number five, the Goo Goo Dolls' Name.
Here's the thing about this, and I wanted to make it almost honorable mention, but instead I gave it the lowest slot I could. It did ruin the band in the sense that they just turned everything was just variations on this specific song. I mean, not even power ballad. Everything just sounds like Name. That being said, I used to tell people, as an old guy does, I used to tell people, kids, there was a time when the Goo Goo Dolls were good. And while I do believe that to be true, listening back to their older records now, while they used to be a lot better than they are and then they became, listening back to them now, they weren't nearly as good as I thought at the time. I like listening to their old stuff, you know, like Superstar Car Wash or even A Boy Named Goo, which I quite liked when it came out.
What year was this? Do you remember?
Like 96.
Okay.
Because it was when I was living in Salt Lake City. So either 95 or 96. The record, I think, came out in 94, but I think it's this hit in 96. Because then he followed it with that song from City of Angels, Iris, you know. And so the Goo Goo Dolls did have some good songs. They were sort of a low-rent replacements, you know. Like if you absolutely couldn't find any replacements record to listen to, you could listen to them. But not nearly as good as I had been telling people they used to be. But, you know, but again, they got tired of not being able to pay the rent. And Johnny Resnick, to his credit, has actually said that. He's like, I got tired of not selling any records. And he's like, I didn't want to go work in a shoe store. So you know what? You got to give the people what they want. So God love them.
This is one of the songs that nothing comes to mind when I hear the song other than driving in my car.
Yeah.
Because I heard this song about 7,000 times on the radio while driving in my car.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of Bon Jovi, when Bon Jovi came to town and I saw them, actually, Goo Goo Dolls opened. And it was a marriage made in heaven. So that tells you what you need to know. Top five ballads that ruined a band. Dawn Taylor?
Kiss, Beth.
It pains me to put Kiss on any sort of a ruined list, but...
And I'm surprised this isn't higher on the list, because it is generally considered, you know...
Choose your words carefully.
I was saying, even by Kiss fans, it's considered an aberration.
Let's walk carefully through these next few moments.
No, no, I have nothing bad to say about Kiss. I really don't, and I wouldn't, but I know people who are... fans of Kiss.
The only reason this isn't higher is because as much as this corrupted Kiss's music to some degree, it didn't do it nearly so badly as the song I Was Made for Loving You, their disco song,
yes.
Which was a huge hit. I mean, I'll take Kiss doing a ballad as will it way before take Kiss doing a disco song. My friend Todd actually got the Dynasty album when it came out, back before everything leaked on the internet. He got the Dynasty album, and he was like 15, took it home and put it on, and the first thing he heard was a disco song, and he cried. He said he sat there and cried, actual adolescent boy tears. This is a beautiful song. I have to say, I really do. And it's a beautiful song largely because Peter Criss can't sing. And so it sounds very sincere. It's got that kind of Man in the Rain sort of a, you know, wistful, you know, Street of Broken Dreams kind of thing.
My very first... real boyfriend was a drummer, and he was it was the summer I graduated from high school, and he was a drummer, and he loved Kiss, and that was my first real experience hearing Kiss. And whereas Kiss never really appealed to me, because of his love of Kiss, I was introduced to Cheap Trick, who I did fall madly in love with. So
this song, though, Gene Simmons has actually talked about the effect that Beth had on the band, this song, where he said it's like an addiction. And he himself is notoriously sort of a teetotaler in all ways. But he said, you know, it's like once you get a little money, you want more money. Once you get a hit single, you want more hit singles. Once girls start coming to your concert, you want more girls to come to your concert. And so as a result, every Kiss album since then has had a song that sounds a lot like this. This song is great, but like everything in the music industry, it gets Xeroxed to the point where it's, you know, a bane. Beautiful song, though. All right, top five ballads that ruined a band. Don Taylor?
Number three, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Under the Bridge.
Do you know how hard it was for me to put the Red Hot Chili to willingly subject myself to their alleged music?
When, and I'll be interested to hear your explanation as to how this ruined.
Well, not in my assessment, because I didn't really ever care for them to begin with. But for what it's worth, the Red Hot Chili Peppers did, I don't know they created it, but they sort of did perform a specific kind of really lame, like, frat guy, hyper-rock funk.
Mm-hmm.
But again, after, and you know, and they didn't really do, you know, a lot of ballads. They didn't do a lot of slow things. They did songs that were, you know, sort of meaningful or wistful or were about things that were, whatever, you know, that were about something other than putting socks on their penises. But you can see a very before, you can see a line of demarcation before the song and after the song. Because after this song, again, every album has at least three or four low tempo, largely acoustic songs that are wistful and have sort of plaintive guitar stylings in the background that are obviously designed just to be hits. And I don't care. Doesn't matter. I don't give a rat's ass, and I'm not going to listen to them. But if I was a Red Hot Chili Peppers fan from, like, the Mother's Milk album and before, I would just sit there and I would just think that my music had been watered down to pablum. You know, things that doesn't matter to me. But if you're somebody who was like, I got the Freaky Styley album and it was awesome. Well, if you think that's awesome, then this is like the worst thing you've ever heard. You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying.
Did you, because you looked skeptical there for a second.
No, I just, I don't know. Red Hot Chili Peppers suck.
They're terrible.
They've
no,
always
awful.
Sucked.
They're awful.
I saw one of these behind the music things or a thing about, you know, the early days of the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And Flea, who is in and of himself awesome. You know, separate from the band. Flea was doing this interesting sort of revisionist history, talking about the early days of the band and how, you know, from the very first shows they ever played, there'd be people lined up around the block to get in. And like, I'm sorry, I saw the Red Hot Chili Peppers during some of the first shows they ever played. They opened for some friends of mine. There were four people in the audience. No one liked them. For the first couple of years they were playing, you know, the only reason they had any audience at all was because girls thought Anthony was cute.
Yeah, that's the deal.
They sucked.
Yeah. No, they've never stopped. They just started sucking in different ways. So it pained me to put this on, but I gotta be honest that this is a song that sort of broke the continuity of the band's music. All right, top five ballads that ruined a band. Don Taylor?
Number two, Queensryche, Silent Lucidity.
All right. This is not nearly so sad a case as our number one song, but here, number two, Silent Lucidity, Queensryche. And again, nothing wrong with the song. You know, a nice song, pretty song, very Pink Floyd, but I mean, it's arranged by Michael Kamen. What are you going to do? This will be made ever more clear with our final song that we'll get to in a second. Then we'll get out of here so Greg and Sarah can move on in. But the problem with the ballad that becomes a big hit, especially if you are a band that has only had moderate success, or even, you know, even actual success, is that the expectations are raised then immediately by the record company. So you've got Queensryche that had, I think, three albums out before this. They had, Rage for Order and... the hell was their other album? Oh, God, I'm getting old. Anyway,
so was this really actually a big hit?
Silent Lucidity? Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it was a huge hit. It's a massive hit. It was all over MTV. I had to play this. I was a top 40 DJ at the time, and I was playing this. But they had Rage for Order, and then what their other one was, and then they had Operation Mindcrime, which was, and Operation Mindcrime went gold, was on its way to going platinum. No hit singles, really, as such, not in the pop world. You know, so the record company went, hey, we got this band Queensryche. They're plugging along. They sell about 300,000, 500,000 records. They're good guys. We like them. You know, whatever. You like when you're showing off your you know, to the stockholders. So when you're selling gold records, the record company's fine. They're like, hey, great, keep selling gold records. You put this out, and suddenly the album Empire sells 3 million copies. And then suddenly you're no longer the band that's expected to sell 500,000 copies. You're the band that's expected to sell 3 million records, and this is a fluke. This is an aberrant song. There's no reason it should have been a hit. I mean, it's a song about lucid dreaming that has weird Pink Floyd orchestral backing to it, sung by a progressive rock band in which no one is good looking, by the way, in which everyone looks weird, except maybe Chris DeGarmo, shouldn't have been a hit. Huge, inexplicable hit. And then suddenly, when the next record sells their normal 500,000, suddenly they're failures. And then what do? Then they go back and they start cloning this song. They put out a song called The Bridge not too long after this. It was just a rewrite of this. And it just becomes sad because then you see, I know that everybody's got to pay the bills, and nobody starts, as I've said many times, nobody starts a band to be anonymous. You start a band to be famous no matter what a guy in flannel tells you. But theoretically, you're doing it playing music that you enjoy. And then when you hear bands consciously, like, replicating themselves in a way that you suspect they probably don't want, you know, it's no good.
Silent lucidity. This had to be for one of these periods when I just wasn't listening to Top 40 radio
everywhere.
Don't know this.
It was a, really?
At all, yeah.
Oh, it was a big hit. This is far and away the biggest hit they've ever had. I mean, massive. Yeah. Boy, I wonder if Roger Waters hears this and just thinks, bastards, pay me. You can just hear that sort of learning to fly thing over. All right, top five ballads that ruined a band. Dawn Taylor, what is our number one song?
Number one is Extreme, More Than Words.
I love Extreme. I really do.
I do too.
I'm such a big fan of these. And you wouldn't talk about.
I was afraid to say that because I was thinking you were going to say I was too much. I was like girl.
No.
Or something.
Well, no, because that's because again, it's like this is a fine song. There's nothing wrong with this song.
Yeah.
It's I'm sick of hearing it.
I've heard this too many times, but I do love this song.
It's a beautiful song. Now, are you familiar with much of the Extreme oeuvre?
Not a huge amount, but yeah, I've heard their other music, and I know that this is not.
It's not representative. But the thing is, they're such an amazing. First of all, they're just amazing musicians, and normally I could care dick about that. But they do it with a really an exceptional care of craft and songwriting and whatever. This and the album this came from, which is called Pornograffiti, is notable because they do like every conceivable style on this record. There's stuff that's very straight ahead hard rock. There's stuff that's like stuff like I typically don't go for, which is sort of a funk rock, which is not really my thing, but they do it really well. There's a song called When I Kissed You, which is a sort of Frank Sinatra big band jazz performance. There's a song called Wholehearted, which is a very like up-tempo pop song. Then there's this. I mean, it's a huge breadth of material. But again, they had a record before this with an album. They had a hit called Don't Want to Go to School Today that was a sort of rock hit, and a song called Decadence Dance, which was actually that was off this record too. But they'd had some moderate success. And the record company probably didn't think anything about this. Just like with Kiss. You know, Kiss was actually a B-side. It wasn't even, it was the B-side of Detroit Rock City. Nobody even thought about it. This, they put it out, and the band has said repeatedly, Extreme has said that they regret ever writing this. They regret putting it out. They wish it had never become a hit because it is what broke up the band. Because every album after this, it was like, okay, but there's some fat bastard A&R guy sitting there going, all right, but I don't hear a single. Do you have it? What about that? What about the words? More words? What is that song? More Than Words. Maury, is there a More Than Words on this record? And then, no, go back to the studio and write one, which is what they tell bands to do. And the band has said that this is why they broke up, the pressure of matching this song. And so, you know, they put out a few more albums that nobody really paid attention to because they didn't have a hit single. So, you know, there you go. Great song, though. There you go. I like to end things as sort of a big down for the week. Awesome. Well, let me just cheer everybody up. I'll just...
Well, here's something that makes me happy. I'll let you know. Somebody in the text box writes in to say that, Rick, per yesterday's discussion of the space station, it's huge. About 5 football fields is correct.
Hey.
I know this because I have poked around NASA's full-size mock-up at Johnson Space Center when I was working for Lockheed. So I knew how big the space station was.
Well done, Dawn Taylor. We'll just go out on that. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the news desk is Dawn Taylor.
With me.
At Advanced Technology and Magic provided by Thomas Gill. Executive producer is Bruce Agler. Chief of staff is Cheryl Kanakoa. We want to thank our guest, Bill Carter. The Rick Emerson Show is made possible by a generous grant from you, from east of the Rockies in the Kingdom of Nye. My name is Rick Emerson. It is Friday, July 30th, 2010, and that is the frequency, Kenneth. After a brief musical interlude, you'll hear an encore of today's Legion of News, followed by this very fine radio program. Have a safe weekend. Thanks for listening. See y'all on Monday. Bye now.
Use your heart as a telephone, and then you'll never be alone. You'll see. You'll be with me. Your heart can do the walking a million, million miles. Your soul.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks for listening.